Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Ireland has one of the highest death rates from ovarian cancer in Europe, and around 400 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer each year in this country. Despite this, though, 79% of women in Ireland aren't confident that they'd notice a symptom of the cancer. Well, joining me to discuss the signs, the symptoms and the treatment for ovarian cancer is Donal Brennan, who's Professor of Gynaecological Oncology and Academic Lead of the UCD Gynaecological Oncology Group. And again, if you have questions for Donal, 51551. You're very welcome. Thank you for coming in. As I was saying to you when you were walking in, we have many questions, but you probably aren't surprised that we don't know what to look out for when it comes to ovarian cancer, because the symptoms might be the types of things that women experience, discomfort in some cases, normally, regularly, and don't pay any heed to.
Exactly, Claire, and thank you for having me. The symptoms for ovarian cancer are vague, and that's the problem, and they're very common. And that's why we've developed this campaign with the Irish National Gynae Oncology Research Group called the BEAT campaign, which is to try and remind people about these symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And you'll explain that to us, B-E-A-A-T.
Yeah. So B-E-A-T, so B is for bloating, which, you know, happens quite a lot. But what we really want to know about is people have persistent bloating for more than 3 weeks, almost constantly. That's really a sign that something, a persistent bloating is something that needs to be investigated and not always put down to things like irritable bowel syndrome and things like that. The second is abdominal pain. The third is feeling full earlier, eating less. And that's something that a lot of patients tell me about and they remember beforehand. And then the last thing is changes in toilet habit, whether that be changes in bowel habit or changes in bladder habit as well.
Mm-hmm. You see, you can, just as you're talking, you can imagine that people are going, I have irritable bowel. Yeah. This is what I have. I know it myself, you know, nothing else. Because those symptoms, people are likely to experience them at different points in their their cycle.
Exactly,
even.
Yeah. So I think that's why it's a persistence of symptoms, or if somebody feels that there's a change in their own body. And I think those symptoms are very common, but one of the things that we learn from looking after women with ovarian cancer is that if and when the cancer does come back, they can identify those symptoms very early. So I think we need to be better at listening to patients, and we need to be better at acting on those symptoms if people are persistently presenting with them.
Is it fair to call it a silent cancer?
It is, and there are lots of other silent cancers, but I think the problem with ovarian cancer is that it spreads very early, and therefore it presents at a very late stage, and by the time it presents, 4 out of 5 women have stage 3 or 4 disease,
so
and that's
when,
what makes it more difficult
to
manage.
And is that when you're seeing people? Yes, in the main?
Yeah, and that's nothing to do with the patients delaying themselves or anything like that. That's the nature of the disease, and in fact all over the world the disease is presenting at a very late stage. So really, it's a very difficult thing to understand why somebody can look very well but have very advanced cancer at the same time. And they often present, as I said, with symptoms that may only be going on for a few weeks. But when you talk to them afterwards and when they look back at things, they've had these BEAT symptoms for quite some time beforehand.
Mm-hmm. So if you have people listening to you today who say, I don't want to be that person who ends up across the desk from Donal Brennan with stage 3 or stage 4, what do we do?
So the first thing is obviously to listen to your body and to keep an eye on those symptoms. And sometimes it's worth, as you said, you know, women are very in tune with their bodies. And I think what we need to know is if you notice a change, particularly in that bloating and that eating early, those two, the first two parts of BEAT, eating or feeling full early, you really need to get checked out. And the best protocol is with your GP initially. Now, everybody will have symptoms from time to time, but if they're persistent, the next step would be to organise an ultrasound scan to assess things. And in Ireland, there have been difficulties getting access to ultrasounds in the past, but I think that we're getting better at accessing those scans. But an ultrasound is a really important test, and it's a much more important test than any blood test or anything like that. A pelvic ultrasound will allow people to assess whether there's any mass on the ovary.
So that's what you ask for?
Yes.
You ask for an ultrasound. And from there then, if something is spotted on that ultrasound, what would you be expecting to see if that person had ovarian cancer?
We might see a cyst on the ovary at an early stage of ovarian cancer. But of course, most cysts on the ovaries that are diagnosed at ultrasound are benign. So, you know, women who have had an ultrasound and a cyst and maybe have had a cyst identified will have 90% of those will be benign or more. And women get cysts on their ovaries all the time, but there are specific features on the ultrasound that will trigger certain action points. If there are sinister features on the ultrasound, we'll often do a blood test called a CA125, which helps add to that whole process of understanding what's going on. And subsequently, then patients may need a biopsy.
Mm-hmm. So it may be possible to look at the results of that ultrasound and see, for example, that somebody had polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Yes, or endometriosis. Or they may have just a normal, simple, benign cyst on their ovary. So there are lots of different things that can cause cysts on their ovaries that are not cancer. But on top of that, I suppose a negative ultrasound or an ultrasound that shows a normal ovary, a normal fallopian tube, a normal uterus is very reassuring.
Mm-hmm. So moving on from there then, if you do get to the point where you need a biopsy, how invasive is that?
So that depends really on the age of the patient. So remember, ovarian cancer really affects women over the age of, the average age of diagnosis is between 60 and 65. So if a lady is postmenopausal and has an abnormal cyst on her ovary that marks any kind of, that kind of raises red flags for us, we would often advise that we go in and we remove that ovary.
Okay.
And that helps us to diagnose those patients who maybe have early stage disease. Of course, unfortunately, in our case, in where I work, a lot of the patients will present where the disease has spread elsewhere, and it'll spread to many different parts of the abdomen. And in that situation, you may have a biopsy done in the radiology department, or you may need to come in to have a keyhole operation to have a biopsy done.
Does that happen at stage 3 and stage 4?
Yes.
And quickly?
Yes, actually, once the diagnosis is made, things happen pretty quickly. And that's the case oftentimes in a lot of cases in Ireland. The delay is actually making the diagnosis rather than getting into the system. But we would consider a new diagnosis of ovarian cancer as a relative emergent situation where we want to try and get things done as quickly as possible, because we do know that if we can operate on patients as quickly as possible, the outcomes are better.
Okay, and what else do you do when it comes to treatment then?
So the treatment is a combination of surgery and chemotherapy, and it's really important that people understand that you need both. And really, there's a lot of debate. We individualise treatment based on each patient and what stage they are and how much disease there may be present and how sick the patient is herself. You know, if the patient's very young, you may be more aggressive surgically. If a patient's very old, you may not be able to be as aggressive because you may have other medical problems. So oftentimes the surgery is quite extensive, can last a number of hours and require, ultimately the goal of surgery is to remove all visible disease. Mm-hmm. And I'll but explain that to you in a minute.
But you won't get it all, so then hence the chemo.
So surgery, yeah, exactly. So if you operate on a patient, you obviously leave microscopic disease behind, and that's where the chemotherapy comes in.
Okay. Now, I had a look at the website, which is linked to this campaign, and it's well worth people having a look at that. And remember that BEAT is what you outlined at the beginning, but this is go.ie is an online resource for people, and you can go and have a look on there. But I was interested to read what it says about the hereditary aspect to this. And the advice is that if you've had two female relatives on either side of your family who've had ovarian cancer, that you should get checked.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Are you happy that that's right? It's not on the maternal line specifically or the paternal line?
No, and definitely not, because the genes that we're worried are called BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they can affect men and women. So particularly, for example, if there's a history of male breast cancer in your family, you definitely should get checked. But we now offer that genetic testing to all patients who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, irrespective of whether they have a family history or not, because we know that almost one in five patients with ovarian cancer will have an abnormality in one of those two genes.
Okay.
And that if we can identify those abnormalities, of course, we can offer their family testing, mm-hmm. but also we have new drugs available that are very effective in that group of patients. So that's kind of been a big change, because historically genetic testing was all about what can you do for your family. But in fact, the genetic testing now is just as important for the women themselves as they head down the treatment
journey. But you may have people listening here who know that they might have had two aunts 20 years ago who had ovarian cancer and died. You know, what do they do?
Well, they need to be, they can definitely be assessed, and then they need to be assessed really within a cancer genetics clinic. And the cancer genetics clinic, the main cancer genetics clinic at the moment in Ireland, is in St James's Hospital. There is quite a significant delay in getting those patients seen, but those patients, if they meet certain criteria, as you said, based on the family history, it's generally first degree relatives that we're worried about. If they're second or third degree relatives, the risk is less, it's still there, but the chances of there being a genetic abnormality is reduced. Having said that, you know, a significant proportion of patients who have the genetic abnormality do not have a family history.
Okay.
And that's why we offer all patients who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer genetic testing at this point.
We better get to our questions, because we have many here. I have persistent pain in my right pelvic area. I'm 70. Can this be a symptom of ovarian cancer?
it can be a symptom of ovarian cancer, but there's lots of other things that can cause pain in the right side of the pelvis as well. And again, coming back to my point that if the patient has persistent pain, she should have an ultrasound. And if that's normal, they can be reassured.
Okay, so GP and ask for an ultrasound.
But again, if it's persistent for a long period of time, it's unlikely to be ovarian cancer because it would have arisen at this point already.
Adele says the symptoms appear to be very similar to menopause, and I think you would agree with that. So hence the confusion amongst women. Also, how is it finally diagnosed if no tests are available? And again, I think if you have persistent symptoms, that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, Dora? And I think the other thing to point out, Claire, is that there is no screening test for ovarian cancer. You can't going for routine scans and blood tests will not be of any benefit. That's been shown in numerous studies. And the other important point is that a negative smear test doesn't in any way reassure somebody about the fact that they don't have ovarian cancer, because of course a smear test is just looking at the cervix.
Mm-hmm. And we should also say, I mean, you said it's very prevalent in women, I think, who are over 60, is that what you said? But it's not unusual for cases to happen in younger women.
No, and we've had patients in their 20s with ovarian cancer. I suppose statistically it's more likely to happen in people over the age of 70. But of course, like all cancers, you can see it in much younger populations as well.
Okay. This listener is 42 and very sadly, she said, my mum and my granny both died from ovarian cancer when they were in their late 60s. What should I do now with such a family history?
So there's somebody who should be considered for initially for genetic testing. And if they were to identify a genetic abnormality, then you would offer her, you would consider offering her risk reducing surgery, which would be to remove her ovaries and tubes before she develops cancer. And if, say, for example, if you have one of these genetic abnormalities in BRCA1 or BRCA2, we advise, and internationally the advice is that those women consider having their ovaries and tubes removed between the ages of 40 and 45 if their families are complete. If there's no genetic abnormality identified, you would consider leaving that lady's ovaries and tubes in until they go through a natural menopause and then consider removing them at that point. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a role for risk reduction in this situation, but there are complications associated with risk reduction too, particularly early onset menopause, which is a significant complication.
Yeah, and it's risk reduction, it's not risk elimination.
Yes, but it does reduce the risk by 95%.
Okay,
so if you have,
yeah,
there's a 5% chance of getting a thing called primary peritoneal cancer, which is very like ovarian cancer, but it's a huge, so if you think about a patient who has a BRCA1 abnormality, she has a 40% chance of developing ovarian cancer by the age of 70. If we remove her ovaries and tubes when she's finished her family, before she develops that cancer, we reduce that risk down to 3-4%.
Okay. So it's worth it, but it's a huge thing to go through, isn't it?
It's a massive thing. And one of the things you have to be very careful about there is these are people who are coming in who are well. There's nothing wrong with them.
Yes.
Okay. And
they're
perfectly fine. And they're coming in to have an operation to reduce their risk of cancer, not to treat their cancer. And by removing their ovaries and tubes, you induce a surgical menopause, which is a very, very debilitating thing. And whilst most of those women can have hormone replacement therapy, we're not 100% sure that hormone replacement therapy is as effective in that group of women as it would be in people who go through a natural menopause. So it's a very important discussion to have with women, that it's not just about reducing your risk of cancer. It's what effect will that have on your life going forward, considering the fact that you're not sick at the moment. So it's a big issue.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a big decision. This one from Liz. Could you please ask about ovarian cysts in a postmenopausal woman? I had an ultrasound. I have a simple cyst. It's about 18 millimetres. That has increased very slightly since the previous scan 6 months ago. Is it okay just to keep monitoring that for the moment?
Yes, and simple is the word there we use. A simple cyst, there's specific things that you look at on the ultrasound, and simple cyst means that it looks like a little water balloon on the ultrasound. There's no worrisome features on it. And simple cysts less than 5 centimetres, it's recommended that they can easily be watched if the blood test, the CA125, is also normal. Mm. And most of those cysts resolve of their own accord, because women get cysts throughout their life. So the simple cyst is the key to the whole thing.
What does a cyst look like if you suspect it's cancerous?
So they call it complex, and what you can see in it is that there are solid and cystic areas within the cancer, and the ultrasoundographer, the radiologist will often perform a test where they can actually see extra blood flow through the cyst as well, and there may also be fluid around the cyst, outside of the cyst, in the actual abdominal cavity itself. Mm-hmm. The other thing that is quite worrying is if there's cysts on both ovaries, so bilateral cysts, they will be another thing that will kind of highlight certain kind of red flags. But there are specific, very, very good, well kind of recognised criteria as to how you risk stratify these ultrasounds to try not to over, because you don't want to upset people as well. Lots of people have cysts that aren't cancer.
That are benign, yeah. This listener, now you've touched on this earlier, but this listener would like to know, should you have the CA125 blood test routinely to detect ovarian cancer? But you're saying there's no screening. There's nothing
no,
you can...
No, and so the UK did an enormous trial of 200,000 women over 15 years, and half of those women went through normal follow-up, no screening. Half had screening and via ultrasound and CA125, and half at CA125 as well. It was probably one of the biggest trials ever done in medicine. And basically there was no difference in either the incidence or the deaths from ovarian cancer.
I just have one here that I know I'm over time, but I want to get to this one. This person here had a full hysterectomy and chemotherapy in 2018 and had ovarian cancer at stage 2B. It returned in 2020, chemotherapy again. It's now starting again. I wonder, can you tell me what might be ahead for me? That could be a difficult one for you to answer, but I'm sure you have seen that before.
We see that's the nature of ovarian cancer, Claire, and that's the thing. You know, I know we're stuck for time, but one of the things that we're very clear about is that even though we try to treat this, we rarely cure people of ovarian cancer, and what we're trying to do is turn it into a chronic disease where we keep people alive and well for as long as possible with the disease. This poor lady gives a very clear kind of story of what we see all the time. She will most likely have to have more chemotherapy, but if the recurrence is more, there's a very significant chance that she will respond well to chemotherapy. And some of these newer drugs that we have, particularly this group of drugs called PARP inhibitors, they seem to be very effective in that group. So we have a lot of new drugs available which are really effective in maintaining and people in remission for periods of time. But I often use the kind of the analogy of HIV back in the 80s, where, you know, when people were diagnosed with HIV, they nearly all died of HIV. And now, of course,
it's changed.
Now, of course, people are living with and will die with HIV, not from HIV. And that's what we're trying to get to with ovarian cancer.
Well, the website is thisisgo.ie, which is an online personalised resource for people if you've been impacted by a gynaecological cancer, or lots of information on there for people who are just curious about the symptoms. It's been so useful to talk to you. Thank you very much. And thanks for taking all of those rapid fire questions. That's Professor Donal Brennan. We'll take a quick break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.